This is biodiversity lecture number 6 on animals, the multicellular heterotrophic eukaryotes. So what actually characterizes an animal? Like I just mentioned, they are multicellular heterotrophic eukaryotes. And it's a great thing to just ask your parents at dinner tonight, you know, do they know what a multicellular heterotrophic eukaryote is? That might be fun little discussion. So you might want to do that. We remember that these organisms are ones that take organic molecules into their body through ingestion, which is eating, right? They lack cell walls. However, they do have cell membranes, just like all cells do. They have that lipid bilayer. So that's just true of anything that's living that is, you know, made of cells. And they have muscle and nervous tissue. For the most part, really primitive animals, it's kind of debatable whether they have this, but most animals have this. And they are characterized by the diploid stage of their life cycle is the dominant stage. And so we, for instance, are animals, and so the diploid phase, we, you know, right now we are diploid organisms, and so we have 23 pairs of chromosomes, and the sperm and the egg that we make are haploid, but they're not the dominant form of animal life or us. You know, they're just single cells. Okay, so let's talk about the origin of animals. The first appearance of an animal was, you guys remember from reading Bill Bryson this summer, when did the first animals appear? Can anyone tell me? Yeah. The Cambrian explosion. You guys remember that from Bryson's book? When was the Cambrian explosion, just roughly? Sam? Very good. Wow. 520 million years ago. That's a pretty good number. Can anyone describe what the Cambrian explosion was? Does anyone know what it was? Yeah. Okay, there was this amazing diversity of animals that all of a sudden appears in the fossil record. Does anyone know where these fossils were found? It was in the book, yeah. Not Greenland, no, yeah. It was shale, but it wasn't in New Zealand, yeah. The Burgess Shale, and where is the Burgess Shale located? Canada. Can you be more specific? Can anyone help him out? That's very good. The Burgess Shale in Canada. What part of Canada? Anyone remember from the reading? Sam. It's in the Rockies. It's actually in British Columbia in the Rockies. And it's this, it's a beautiful spot. In fact, I've been there in 1993. I went there and here's a panorama picture of the Burgess Shale. It's just this little chunk of the hillside, and there's my sister holding a piece of shale, and the animals are little. They're maybe about, you know, a couple inches long, and they're all, of course, flattened in the shale, but you can see them. It's really remarkable, and this is where this is evidence of the first really diversification of animal life, and I'll pass this around so you can take a look at it. So the Burgess Shale. Now, it turns out that the first animal probably appeared around 700 million years ago, and we believe it was an ancestral protist that actually acquired multicellularity. By the time the Burgess Shale comes along, which is, you know, the Cambrian explosion, it's, you know, a couple hundred million years later, and now you've got actually multicellular animals that, and you see all, you know, this pretty much the diversity similar to the diversity that we see today. Except they're very small. The first animal, of course, appeared 700 million. Now, after reading Bryson's book, if you read it carefully, before the Burgess Shale, there actually was another kind of animal life that appeared. Does anyone remember what that was? Yeah. No, trilobites actually were part of the, you know, kind of after the Burgess Shale. And he goes into that quite a bit. And they were around for a long time. But there was something before trilobites, something before the Cambrian explosion. Yeah. Not Perizoans, no. What was it? Anybody know where it was found? Maybe you'll know where it was found, but you don't remember what it was called. Okay. They were called the Ediacara, and they were found in Australia. Do you remember this? It was named after the hills, the Ediacara Hills, and they're these sort of flat pancake-looking things that kind of look like jellyfish almost. Do you remember reading about that? Okay, those were the first real evidence of multicellular animal life on the planet, and it's somewhere between 700 and 500 million years ago. Okay, and so animals have been evolving ever since, and when we look at the evolution of animal life, we actually look at four major branch points. And this is what you're going to really need to know. And if you actually look at the very first branch point here, you'll see on the right-hand side of the slide a beautiful sort of illustration of the evolution of animals. And I want to just note right now that you're going to need to memorize this. So you might as well start this weekend. This actually was one of the essay questions on the AP Bio exam several years ago. You had to kind of reproduce this diagram and talk about the branch points and why they occurred and what was the difference. You know, why did this branch this way and this branch that way? So this is really a summary of all of animal evolution on one slide. Okay? So the very first division between animal, you know, in the animal, in the evolution of animals was what we call eumetazoans separate from perizoans. And the perizoans is the first group that comes off, that branches off here to the left. And the word para means beside, and zoa means animals. In fact, that's where we get our term zoo, right, where we keep animals. And these animals, the perizoans, they don't really have true tissues. And, you know, the term perizoa means beside the animals. And the reason they have this terminology is because they really don't look like animals. They don't really have true tissues. And, in fact, they're even given their own subkingdom, the perizoa. And what group of organisms represents the perizoa? Does anyone know? Anyone know from their reading or anything? Yeah. Yeah, they don't have tissues, but I'm wondering, like, what organisms characterize them? Yeah. Yeah, sponges. And if you actually look, you know, if you look at a sponge, it doesn't even look like an animal. And I remember when I first took my first zoology class at UC Davis, you know, I remember learning about, you know, sponges, and I was like, oh, I don't even think at the time I knew that they were animals. I was, like, surprised. I remember, like, wow, really, they're animals? Yeah, they are. And they're in this phylum Porifera. Could everyone say that for me, Porifera? And I want to just remind you, remember Linnaeus, you know, Carolus Linnaeus, the guy who came up with the classification scheme back in the 1700s? He was the first guy, if you remember from the reading this summer, who came up with kingdom, phylum, you know, you remember that whole thing? So we have five kingdoms now, and what you're going to need to start learning are the different phyla in you know, the animal kingdom. And the first one you need to know is Porifera. And so you're going to know a bunch of these phyla. Those of you that are going to go to Catalina Island with me in a few weeks, you're going to be reviewing this a lot, because your instructors, we do a whole lab on invertebrates, and you're going to have to remember all these phyla, because they're going to be shooting questions at you, like, you know, do you know this? Do you know that? And you're going to have to identify them. So it's kind of a good review of what we're learning today. Okay, so the next group of organisms are called eumetazoans, animals with true tissues, and eu means good or true, meta means after, and so eumetazoan means good after animals or true after animals. And it's really another subkingdom within the animal kingdom, and these good animals are the ones that came after the first animals. And sometimes the terminology protozoans refers to the first animals. Now we don't really use that terminology, but they used to, you know, we used to think of, you know, the early animals as protozoans. And right now, if you look at this illustration on the left or the right here, the first branching point are all the perizoans, which is basically the sponges. Everything else are eumetazoans. Everything else have actually true tissues. So the second branch point are organisms where we separate bilateral symmetry from radial symmetry. And animals that are radially symmetrical are ones that it's, you know, the way I like to think about it, think of it like a pizza. It's something that, a pizza is something, as long as you run something through the middle, you can divide it multiple times and still get the same mirror image, or a cake or something like that. Those kinds of organisms are radially symmetrical. And the phylum that characterizes this is the Cnidaria. And it starts with a C, but it's a silent C. And so you pronounce this Cnidaria. Can you guys pronounce it, Cnidaria? And it includes organisms like the jellyfish and the sea anemone. Once again, we'll see some of these on Catalina Island. Bilateral symmetry are organisms that can only be sort of cut in half in one orientation, and then you'll get a mirror image. So, like, for instance, we are bilaterally symmetrical. If you sort of cut us down the middle, you know, we've got two arms, two legs, two eyes, and so forth. And so then you get your mirror image. If you look at my illustration on the right here, there's sort of the way we talk about this, we use the term dorsal, which is the back, ventral is the belly, anterior is the front or where the head is, and posterior is where the tail is. And so sort of learn those orientations because we'll talk about that when we do dissections and so forth in the class. There's a really important term you need to know. By the way, this term, cephalization, actually appeared on the AP Bio test a couple years ago. And a lot of my students said, well, you never taught it to us. And I said, yes, I did. I taught you the first week of school, and then they forgot it in May. So don't forget it. This is an important term. Cephalization is a concentration of nervous tissue in the anterior end of an organism. And this happens evolutionarily. And it makes sense because if the anterior end of the organism is the part of the organism that's moving through the environment, you'd want to put a lot of nervous tissue up here to sense the environment and also respond to the environment, whether to go towards something or go away from something. And if you look at the evolution of animals, there's an increasing concentration of this nervous tissue as we get to higher and higher organisms until we get to ourselves and we get the most complex example of cephalization, which is the human brain. So there's been a sort of an evolution of that throughout the history of animal evolution. Okay, so if we look at the evolution of radially symmetrical versus bilaterally symmetrical organisms, there's another thing that characterizes these guys, and it's on the next slide. Radially symmetrical animals are what we call diploblastic. Diploblastic. Can you all say that for me? Diploblastic. And diplo means two, and blast refers to bud, sprout, or germ. And what we think, what we mean by this is that they have two tissue layers or two germ layers. And what that means is they have an outer and an inner. And so the outer layer is called the ectoderm or outer skin and endoderm, which is inner skin. They just have two tissue layers. And so jellyfish, which are radially symmetrical, only have two tissue layers. Now, the bilaterally symmetrical organisms are triploblastic, which means they have three tissue layers. And so they have ectoderm, which is the outer skin. They have mesoderm, which is the middle skin, and endoderm, which is the inner skin. So they have three tissue layers. And we'll see that in all of its glory in the next slide. But before we leave, look once again at the picture of animal evolution, and you will see the radially symmetrical organisms now branch off to the left. And if you go up, you'll see that it includes the Cnidaria, which are the jellyfish and sea anemones. And then everything else is bilaterally symmetrical and also triploblastic. Okay, so in order to look at all the bilaterally symmetrical organisms and sort of separate them from one another, one of the ways we do this is through the presence or absence of what's called a coelome. And that's spelled C-O-E-L-O-M, but it's pronounced coelome. Can everyone say that for me, coelome? Great. And what the coelome is a body cavity within the mesoderm. So that middle tissue has a kind of a hole in it, and that's what the coelome is. Now, there are three varieties of organisms that are bilaterally symmetrical. We have acoelomates, pseudocoelomates, and coelomates. Let's see if you guys can sort of decipher these words based on the Greek and Latin roots. What do you think an acoelomate is like? What do you think, Jack? No coelom. Very good. What do you think a pseudocoelomate is like? Yeah. Very good. A false or fake coelom. And what about a coelomate? What is that? What do you think that has? Anyone want to make a guess? It's one that actually has that coelom, that has that inner cavity. And so let's take a look in more detail at those differences. So the first group of organisms, which are called acoelomates, can everyone say that for me? Acoelomates. They'll, if you look at the picture on the right here, this is a picture of a flatworm. You guys have probably played around with flatworms in a previous bio class. And if you do a cross-section, you'll see the outer, in this particular illustration, the outer layer, the ectoderm, is colored in blue. The endoderm is colored in yellow. And then the mesoderm is colored in red. And you'll see that there is no cavity within the mesoderm. So this is an acoelomate. Now, I want to warn you, if you look at the endoderm, which is that yellow tissue in the middle, you will see a cavity in there. That cavity is the digestive tract. That is not the mesoderm, okay? So that center, you know, is completely different. It's just it's called the digestive tract. And the example of this, of course, is the flatworm. Now, the next group are the pseudocoelomates. Can you all say that for me? Pseudocoelomates. These are the ones with false coelom. And if you look at the illustration on the right, you will see this is an example. It's a nematode or a roundworm. And if you look at the cross-section, you'll see the blue ectoderm on the outside. You'll see the yellow endoderm on the inside. And then you'll see the red mesoderm. But what you'll also notice is there is a space between the mesoderm and the endoderm. Now, so there is a cavity, but it's not within the mesoderm, it's between the mesoderm and the endoderm. And because it's not a cavity within the mesoderm, we call it a pseudocoelom. So you might get faked out and think it's a coelom, but it really isn't. Okay? And then finally, the last group of organisms are coelomates. And can you all say that for me? Coelomates. And they have a true coelom, and if you look at the cross-section, the example here is the annelid or the common earthworm. The cross-section here, you've got your blue ectoderm on the outside, the yellow mesoderm or the yellow endoderm on the inside, and then you've got your red mesoderm. But if you actually look at the mesoderm, you actually see that there's a hole in the mesoderm. And because there's a hole in the mesoderm, there's a cavity in the mesoderm, this is a true coelom, so these organisms are called coelomates. And by the way, surprise, surprise, guess what you are? You guys are all coelomates, and so am I, okay? We're all coelomates. So we have like a cavity within our mesoderm. Okay, now we're going to branch point four. Branch point four gets, this is where the next part of this lecture is the most confusing part. So pay close attention. If you want to take all the coelomates and divide them into two categories, we divide them into protostomes and deuterostomes. Can you all repeat? Protostomes. Deuterostomes. Okay. Now, how do we come up with these divisions? These divisions are a little bit harder. And the people that really made this, sort of branching off of animals and sort of described it were embryologists, because they, in order to do this, they actually looked at the embryo form of all these animals, and then that's how they kind of figured out the differences. So you need to be an embryologist to really follow this, but we can understand, you know, sort of after the fact, as the embryologist sort of explained to us. And the three things they're looking for are the cleavage pattern of the zygote. So we go back. Remember that the zygote is the result of an egg being fertilized by a sperm. So when that happens, the very first cell of life is called a zygote. So every animal starts out its life as a zygote. You all, at one time, were a zygote. You all were a single cell. You know, if you had a picture of you when you were like a zygote, then that would be like your baby picture, okay? What happens when a sperm fertilizes an egg is the zygote will then start going through a number of cell divisions. But what's interesting is the size doesn't change. So you'll have this big zygote, and then it will just divide in half and then divide again and divide again. And you'll get a mass of cells that is exactly the same size as the original zygote. It doesn't actually change its size. And that process is called cleavage, okay? And the way cleavage happens is different for protostomes and deuterostomes. Another difference is the way the coelom forms in protostomes is different than the way the coelom forms in deuterostomes. And finally, there's this thing called the blastopore, which is what the blastopore becomes is different in a protostome versus a deuterostome. And by the way, what the blastopore is, a little bit later, after the zygote starts to divide more, it'll form a ball of cells. Just a big, it looks like a basketball, essentially. It'll be sort of full of fluid in the middle. It's called the blastula. And eventually what happens is somewhere along that ball of cells, it starts to invaginate. It starts to go in on itself. And therefore it forms a hole right there where it's part of it starts to fold in on itself. That hole is called the blastopore. And what that blastopore becomes is different if you're a protostome or a deuterostome. In one case, it'll become the anus. And the other will become the mouth. And we'll talk about that in a second. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about cleavage. And so in the next slide, you will see two different patterns of cleavage. What you see here is that on the left, you see an example of a protostome, and on the right, you see an example of a deuterostome. And if you look carefully, you'll notice that there's a very subtle difference. In the left-hand picture, the protostome, you'll see that the actual cells that have started to divide, when they divide, they're not on top of each other. They actually move, so they're kind of above the groove. Okay, that's kind of cool. They move, so they're above the groove. So they're not literally on top of one another. Embryologists call that spiral cleavage, because it's kind of rotating as it goes through cleavage. And that's what protostomes do. Deuterostomes are different. When they go through cleavage, the cells are literally right on top of one another, and so they don't rotate, and that's called radial cleavage. So they're distinctly different. And you could actually, you know, if we had a microscope and we could look at these, you could actually see that. Now, the thing that you can't see, but an embryologist could tell you, is that in the protostomes, if you took one of those cells, they know exactly what the fate of that cell is going to be. They know exactly what kind of tissue that's going to be. So it's already determined. So we say that the fate of this is determinate. And so that's where the word determinant comes from. It's got a fate. They know exactly what that cell is going to become. With a deuterostome, if you take one of those cells, none of those cells really have a fate yet. Any one of those cells can become any kind of tissue. So we say, well, the cells are indeterminate. We don't really know. They're not determined yet. They will be at some point, but not yet. So that's the difference. So protostomes have spiral cleavage, and their cells are determined, they're fated, They know what they're going to be. And deuterostomes have radial cleavage, and the cells, we don't know quite what, they can be anything. They're indeterminate. Okay, the next thing that distinguishes them from one another is the formation of the coelom. And here you will see a picture. On the left, you'll see a picture of the protostome cleavage, and on the right, the deuterostome cleavage. Now, if you look on the left, you'll actually see the formation. Remember I told you how the there's an invagination of the tissue, and you form this cavity. The cavity is called the arc interon. Arc means old, and interon refers to intestine. This is going to actually become the digestive tract. And it's the, you know, it's the old intestine. In other words, it's the beginning of the formation of the intestines. And what you'll notice is the yellow is endoderm, the blue is ectoderm, and then you see the red, which is the mesoderm, and you actually see that the mesoderm is starting to split to form a coelom. If that's how it forms, we call that schizocoelous, because we know that the word schizo, you know, means to split, like schizophrenic, you know, split personality. So that's how protostomes form their coelom. They literally take the mesoderm and they form a cavity inside of it by splitting. Over here, deuterostomes, what they do is they bud off, and when they bud off, they form a little coelom sort of by budding off, and we call that enterocoelous because they form out of what's going to be the intestine. They kind of form a little mesoderm, and then they form a cavity. So it's basically, they both form, they both have coeloms, but they just form them in different ways. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about is the fate of the blastopore. So remember, when the invagination of the blastula happens, you get a pore there. Well, what does that blastopore become? On the left here, you will see, actually, if you look at the left and the right, they kind of look almost identical. But it turns out that on the left, these are the protostomes. What happens here is the mouth, the blastopore will become the mouth, and then somewhere else, you'll get an anus forming. And that's why they're called protostome. Proto means first, stome means mouth. And it means the first hole becomes the mouth. So the blastopore becomes the mouth. Deuterostomes, the word deutero means second, stome means mouth, so these, the mouth forms in a secondary place. So actually, the deuterostomes form their anus at the blastopore, and then later, somewhere else, they form the mouth. So the mouth forms secondarily. And so of these two groups of coelomates, which one are we? Are we protostomes or are we deuterostomes? Which ones are we? Someone raise their hand. Yeah, Jack. We're deuterostomes. Our, the very first pore that formed when we were little embryos became our anus, and somewhere else our mouth formed. Okay, that's what deuterostomes are, and that's what we are. And if you look at this picture one more time of the evolution of animals, look here. Everything up here on the right-hand side, are these are all your coelomates. These are your protostomes, and these are your deuterostomes. And look at, there aren't very, the deuterostomes are just two main phyla. Here we are, we're chordata, we have backbones, so we're chordata. And then the other group is called echinodermata. What organisms are in echinodermata? Does anyone know? Yeah, I heard someone say it. Starfish. So we are related, we are brothers and sisters of starfish. Because we both formed our anus from the blastopore, okay, and our mouth somewhere else.